Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Thank you for joining us in this latest edition of the OIES podcast series. My name is Anouk Honoré. I'm a senior research fellow at the OIES, and I was the managing editor of the Oxford Energy Forum, which focuses on the decarbonization of heat in the European building sector. This journal was published by the Institute in February 2023. We have recorded three podcasts in which some of the authors discuss different aspects of this complex but fascinating topic: policy, practical challenges, and the importance of local specificities. We hope you enjoy listening to them.
In this podcast, we discuss the challenges and the practicalities in the decarbonisation of heat in the European building sector. And in this, my first conversation, I'm talking to Alex Chambris, who's Vice President of Global Public Affairs and Sustainability at Viessmann Group, a leading manufacturer in heating and cooling systems. And she wrote the chapter RE Heat EU, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for energy security and climate protection in the recent Oxford Energy Forum magazine. Now, Alex, in your OEF paper, which is titled A Once-in-a-Lifetime Opportunity for Energy and Climate Protection, can I ask you why and also what is the opportunity?
The opportunity of a lifetime that we are facing today is the decarbonisation of the EU building stock, and especially the decarbonisation of the heating system within this building stock. And here's why. The war in Ukraine has fundamentally changed our perception of EU buildings and the way we heat them. So I explain myself. Before the war, we knew already that 30% of global greenhouse gas emissions come from buildings, and we knew that the clock is ticking. The clock is ticking. We had one decade left, according to climate scientists, to halve global emissions by 2030 compared to 2020. Clock is ticking, yet progress is limited. And here is the war. The war has led to a paradigm shift in buildings, in the sense that the decarbonization of buildings is no longer just a climate issue. It has become a key success factor for energy security in Europe. And why that? Because 30% of the Russian gas that was imported into Europe before the war was used to heat residential buildings. Therefore, the replacement of fossil fuels by renewable energy in European buildings not only is good for the climate, but also reduces our dependency on Russian imported energy. And I believe that this new geopolitical situation increases the possibility to see a green swan in buildings.
Ah, now you refer to green swan in your paper. You know, perhaps you could tell us, what do you mean by that term?
Thank you, David. A green swan is the opposite of a black swan. So we are used to the word black swan, for example, for financial crisis. A black swan is an unforeseen, unpredicted event that has a massive negative impact on the economy or a sector. A green swan is simply the opposite. It's an unpredicted event that massively transforms the economy in a positive way.
Okay, so why do you think we may see a green swan in the buildings across Europe then?
The green swan, I say in my article, could take the shape, actually, of a heat pump. And I think there are three reasons why we may see a green swan in building. One relates to consumers, the second one to private sector, and the third to policymakers. So first reason why we could see a green swan is because of the change in consumer preferences that has been induced by the, you know, the effect of the war in Ukraine. And two things: the awareness shock of the consumer about their role, their role of the heating system in the no longer, you know, acceptable dependency on Russian energy. And the second issue is the impact of the rising energy prices on the energy bill of consumers, which increases the willingness, you know, to change and move away from fossil fuels into renewables. So awareness shock among consumers. The second condition for a green swan is the incredible investment readiness that we see in the private sector. And the IEA collected recently, you know, the announcement from the private companies on how much they are willing to invest in renewables and especially heat pumps, and they came over 4 billion. And we in Viessmann, we also have made our own list of claims by other companies, and we found that if you add up all the claims, we will very probably exceed 5 million annual heat pumps per year in production capacity in Europe by 2025 or later. So we see this incredible investment readiness. Alone by Viessmann, we announced that we are ready to invest 1 billion in the next 3 years. So you see another paradigm shift. And the third reason for a green swan, which I explained very well in my article, is the shift in policies. And I think very few people are aware of the combined transformation that the policy framework could lead. And in my article, I list all the policy initiatives at EU level and some at the national level that will literally transform our market. And to give you a hint, I mentioned, for example, that in the European Performance of Buildings Directive, now the decision makers are agreeing on a sunset date for the use of fossil fuels in buildings. And I believe that this sunset date alone could have a massive impact on our market, because the discussion at the EU level is not if we should adopt a sunset date. The question is only when that sunset date should kick in. Is it 2035 or 2040? And once you have a sunset date for the use of fossil fuels in buildings, it means it's a de facto mandatory modernization requirement for the entire buildings across Europe. So you can already imagine the new business model that we can invent in Viessmann or elsewhere, but also the impact on the population. So again, a massive shift in the market, an accelerated transformation, and this will lead to a higher ramp-up of heat pump, to my point of view.
So hearing that, you know, industrial policy is obviously key. So can you perhaps tell us, you know, what are the factors that could drive success in industrial policy?
Let me start first by explaining why we need an industrial policy. What are we aiming at? So I want to remind the listeners to this podcast that the EU has set itself a target within REPowerEU, the REPowerEU strategy, a target that we shall reach 10 million additional heat pumps installed across the EU building stock by 2027. 10 million more heat pumps, what does it mean? Is it much? In fact, if you look at the current installed base, so the heat pump that we have been installing about, you know, over the past 20 years, we reached an installed base of 8.8 million heat pumps. 8.8 million installed, and we want to add up on top 10 more million within 5 years. So you see how massive that is. And then on top, by 2030, we want to reach at least 30 million or more additional heat pumps. So this is an enormous transformation we are talking about. And one challenge is to secure that these additional heat pumps are produced in Europe, that the European manufacturer keep the front, the first mover advantage, that we keep the jobs in Europe. And everybody, when we think heat pumps, everybody has a PV story in mind. We used to be a first mover in the PV field, and now we lost the entire industrial footprint in PV within a few years at EU level. We don't want to repeat that for heat pumps. We don't want to replace a dependency, the dependency on Russian fossil fuels, by another dependency, the dependency on the heat, space heaters or heat pump. So a challenge is, how do we ramp up production capacity while protecting keeping a competitive advantage for the European manufacturing sector? And the EU is adopting a set of measures like the Net Zero Industry Act. It has revised the state aid rules. It plans an action plan for heat pumps. And in my article, if you'd like to hear more, I give a few ideas of what I believe should be included in an industrial policy targeting heat pumps.
Well, Alex, fantastic. And now I understand why you're talking about Reheat EU rather than the Repower EU, because of the importance of what we've just discussed about in this podcast. So thank you, Alex, so much for your time today and your contribution to the OEF.
are now joined by Dr. Christoph Riechmann, who's Director of Frontier Economics, who authored the chapter Low Carbon Heating, How Can We Manage to Peak Winter Demand? This was authored with Matthias Janssen, who's Associate Director at Frontier Economics. Now, Christoph, if I may start by asking, you know, from a system perspective, you know, electric heat pumps appear as a very efficient solution for decarbonizing heat. Now, if many of us install heat pumps at home, what challenges do you think that would pose from a system perspective?
Yes, that's an excellent question. And indeed, we're all aware that heat pumps are a very efficient technology when we consider them in isolation. Obviously, the challenge is that we're hoping not only a few individuals to install heat pumps, but really for the vast swathe of users of energy in future to install heat pumps. So we need to think about a world where most households have installed a heat pump. The challenge then becomes that demand, which was previously met from fossil sources like gas or oil, would then need to be served from electricity because heat pumps are a run off electricity. Now, meeting that heat demand with conventional thermal technologies was relatively easy because they are easily storable. Gas is easily storable, oil is easily storable. And we need to meet that heat demand, particularly in winter when we have the coldest days of the year. So we store gas and oil all year round, more or less, to be there in the cold spells in winter. Now, think about similar worlds, but now we've all switched to heat pumps. So the demand is now very much an electric demand. We run into a cold spell, everyone switches on their heating, and this heating is now not fed from oil and gas, which we have in storage, but it needs to come from the electricity grid. Electricity not being easily storable, that demand needs to be instantaneously met, which poses challenges, especially if the aim is for that electricity to be renewable electricity, so predominantly from wind farms and from solar. So the question then is, will that electric energy be there precisely when we need it? And the possibility is that it won't be. So we'll need to think about new forms of energy storage to be able to meet demand, but also recognizing that much of this demand for heat pump will need to be instantaneously met. Now, storing energy in the form of electricity isn't a very efficient thing to do if you want to store it for more than a few days. And when we're thinking about heat demand, this is largely a winter demand, so a demand that we observe between the months of October, November, and February, March. So we actually need to store energy over quite a long period, and to do that purely in the form of electricity is going to be very expensive, and we also probably lack the space to do it because energy stored in the form of electricity is not a very dense form of energy storage. So at least as a backup, we need other technologies as well. So we will need to be able to store some energy in other forms, which we could then use to fuel heat pumps. So this could be low carbon gases, low carbon fuels, and so on.
You mentioned low carbon gases, Christoph. What is the potential for them?
So the potential as of now is not entirely clear. So we know of various pathways of producing gas and also liquid fuels in a sustainable manner. We're already using biogas. We're already using biomethane. And there's an opportunity to also produce hydrogen from green electricity. So this is a relatively nascent technology. We're investing countries are investing a lot into their further development, into their scaling up. And certainly the experiences we have with a conventional hydrogen sector, for example, in the petrochemical sector, gives us the comfort that this is a technology and an industry that can be scaled, especially when we consider that the primary energy will be renewable electricity, therefore electricity, and we already know how to produce hydrogen, for example, from electricity. So the key challenge then just becomes to build up the full chain from renewables right down to the hydrogen production.
Well, why don't we now perhaps talk about the barriers for a few minutes? You know, what barriers and market failures do you think could limit a natural transition to a decarbonized heating sector?
There are a number of barriers that we need to address. So first of all, there's a significant need for coordination in the energy system, especially when we're talking not just about installing individual heat pumps. We're talking about major shifts in systems. We need to coordinate in terms of building out electrical system, possibly winding down parts of the gas system and so on. And so that requires coordination across the value chain. A further barrier is that some of the required investments from a household perspective are actually quite significant investments. And the experience is that households don't look too much into the future. So they see the large lump investment up front, and they not value as much the future savings that they may be achieving 5 and 10 years down the line. So again, we need to think about that, help them with that. We also need to recognize that some of the technologies we're considering, they're still relatively immature. So while heat pumps themselves are now relatively tested technology, some of the auxiliary technologies that we need in terms of storing energy, also storing energy, renewable energy in liquid and gaseous form, there are technologies which are still emerging, and we need to make sure that we learn more about these technologies and that we support them so that they can scale up, slide down the learning curve. Then we also need to be aware that there can be significant distortions in the existing policy framework. So historically, we've promoted certain technologies. Lots of people are still in the mindset that a certain technology they may have installed a few years ago is still a great technology, although actually from a policy perspective, we've moved on. And one particular issue in this regard is the fact that we have started taxing various fuels. So, for example, we've started taxing electricity, partly to fund renewable programs, partly to get everyone to use less electricity. Now, suddenly, we're telling people that actually, rather than using gas for heating, they should be using electric heat pumps, which means they should actually be using more electricity. So we need to reconsider and look at tax structures, the price structures between different fuels, to make sure that using electricity for heating is actually a sensible proposition.
So Christoph, you know, you mentioned policy, you know, perhaps briefly, you know, what issues and challenges do you think policymakers should be addressing in relation to decarbonisation of the heating sector and also, you know, the need to meet peak winter demand?
Yep. Yes, indeed. So I think some of the policy recommendations, they follow from what I said previously. So we need to look at the issues from a systemic perspective, not just look at individual heat pumps in isolation. We need to look at the overall system effects, the effects on the electricity system. We need to pilot new technologies. Not all of the technologies are fully developed. We need to keep technology options open because we don't know how certain technologies will ultimately perform. So we need to keep an open mind about some technologies. We also need supply chain stability. So it's quite important that we don't only think about one level in the value chain, for example, the installation of heat pumps. We need to make sure that there's a full supply chain from the manufacture of heat pumps right down to the installation. We need to recognize the consumer perspective, and we need to overcome some of the barriers and hurdles that consumers say. My personal conviction is that ideally that is not done through prohibitions, although some governments like to work with prohibitions. And ultimately, we need to remove any distortions in the prices, especially between gas and electricity. So we need to price them and tax them on a par and not tax one for its environmental impact, but not tax another fuel. That's a very quick overview of some of the policy choices to be made.
And of course, you could read more in the article, which Christophe and Matthijs has actually written in the OEF. Well, look, Christophe, thank you very much for your time today and also for your contribution to the OEF.
It's my pleasure to now talk to Oksana Krasasenka, and she is Director, Knowledge Transfer at Euroheat and Power, who authored the OEF article, Harnessing the Decarbonisation Potential of District Heating in Europe, with Michael Wiggin, who's senior advisor, and also with André Gentsch, who's operating agent at the International Energy Agency Technology Collaboration Programme on District Heating and Cooling. Oksana, could we perhaps start by you giving us an overview of the current district heating market in Europe and the fuel mix?
District heating and cooling represents around 12% of the European heating market. Unfortunately, a significant share of fossil fuels is still present in the district heating fuel mix, with almost half of it being natural gas. Meanwhile, nearly 30% of district heating production is covered by renewables, biomass, geothermal, solar thermal, and industrial excess heat, which makes Europe the world leader in the field of renewable district heating. We can see that district heating and cooling has been a gateway to deploy more renewables in home heating. For example, the seven European countries with the highest national shares of renewable heating and cooling also have the highest shares of district heating in their heat markets. And those are Iceland, Sweden, Estonia, Finland, Latvia, Denmark, and Lithuania. Needless to say that the share of district heating in Europe varies significantly from one region to another. District heating is by far the most common heating solution in cold winter countries in Northern and Eastern Europe, whereas it still plays a minor role in Southern and some Western European countries. Overall, Germany has the largest district heating market in Europe, followed by Poland and Sweden.
So, Oksana, what is the potential to expand clean district heating in Europe then?
Several studies are in agreement that there is a great potential for expanding clean district heating in Europe. According to the German think tank Agora Energiewende, district heating could supply 20% of heat in buildings by 2030, with 50% of it supplied by renewables and waste heat. According to another flagship European study, Heat Roadmap Europe, if the urbanization trend continues and appropriate investments are put in place, district heating could meet almost half of Europe's heat demand by 2050. Speaking about people and not percentages, approximately 60 million citizens within the European Union are currently served by district heating. And there is an additional 80 million living in cities with already one district heating system. And these numbers highlight the strong potential of district energy networks to expand and, in combination with renewables, to serve as an alternative way to meet the challenge of urban densification and support the transition of the European building stock away from fossil fuel heating.
So, Oksana, could you perhaps explain to our listeners what the main transformation strategies are for district heating and cooling?
It's clear that the heating and cooling sector must accelerate its transition away from fossil fuels. And on this journey, there is at least three well-proven strategies for district heating. First and foremost, we should support the deployment and integration of sustainable renewable heat sources, such as geothermal, sustainable bioenergy, and solar thermal. These can be integrated swiftly into existing and future district energy networks to replace polluting fossil fuels. And some policies can foster the development of renewable district heating, such as, for example, French Heat Fund or Heat Network Fund in Scotland. Secondly, we need to foster integration of the electricity and heating sectors, also known as sector coupling. District energy networks coupled with large heat pumps and thermal storage can convert excess renewable electricity into renewable heat, providing cost-efficient balancing and storage to the electricity grid. And last but not least, we need to encourage the recovery of waste heat from industrial processes like paper and cement, energy production such as electrolysis, or tertiary activities like data centers. According to HeatRoadMap Europe, up to 25% of district heating could be supplied by industrial heat. Furthermore, urban waste heat sources from data centers, metro stations, tertiary buildings, and wastewater treatment plants can meet more than 14% of the EU's total energy demand for heating and hot water. And this data comes from the European project Reuse Heat. There are also a substantial potential of waste heat recuperation from hydrogen, which should also be considered. Just to summarize, these strategies are easier to implement within new networks, but existing networks, 10,000 in total in Europe, also have a large potential to progressively shift to cleaner approaches.
Thank you, Oksana, very much, and indeed all our interviewees today, for their input to this podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it and that it builds on the Oxford Energy Forum publication, Decarbonising Heat in the European Building Sector, Options, Progress and Challenges, that was published by the Institute in February 2023. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our original research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity or China research programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.